Day. This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And now I get to talk to Cassandra Clare. Hi, Cassandra.
Hi.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. This is so thrilling. You know, you are setting the bar so high because, you know, most authors, when they come along and they're writing books, and they dream about being number one on Amazon. Maybe they dream about being a New York Times bestseller. And of course, you've achieved that. Then few imagine they're going to be global bestsellers like you. And now, I mean, now you're embargoed. Now that has to be the highest honor for an author ever.
I think it is, but I think it's quite funny because when you are thinking about becoming an author, you don't know about how any of that works. So you don't know what it means to be embargoed or to have a strict on-sale date or all of those things that, you know, if you're in the business, are suddenly a really big deal.
Yeah, you know, and of course, my listeners who are listening, and so many are, you know, people who write, my catchphrase at the beginning of every show is, Joy on Paper is for writers and those who dream of writing. So a lot of dreamers listen to this. I've had about a dozen authors who were auctioned, which was a big deal. But mm-hmm. your
that
way, you're in the stratosphere.
You know, you never feel that way. You always feel like there's some new goal, some new thing you want to hit, some, you know, I don't know, imagine thing out there by which, you know, you have yet to achieve. I think we all have that to some extent.
Well, maybe we're all gonna, the next one is, if you want to read Cassandra, you got to take that trip to the moon because, I mean, what more? I know you've sold over 50 million books, but another one that really is a goal for authors, and I had not thought about it before, is the Oxford Union. To speak at Oxford Union,
yeah.
Isn't that, were you like, did it give you a thrill?
I totally did. I immediately ran to send that, when they sent me the email invitation, I immediately went to send it to my mother because I knew she would understand what a big deal it was because my mom is a big Anglophile and she raised me to love England. We lived in London for a long time. You know, she raised me to read like a lot of British writers, and so I was thrilled and I knew that she would be thrilled. And in fact, she was so thrilled that she insisted that she come with me, and
well,
she did.
Definitely. I mean, that it is thrilling because I lived in England when, and this is funny because a little bit of connection to with Jane Austen. When I was 11 years old, I decided that I was going to move to England and live near where Jane Austen was born.
Oh.
So when I was 21 years old, I had saved 20 through all my jobs and working, really sometimes three jobs. I saved $25,000 in those days. I went to England and I bought a 400-year-old cottage not far, 30 minutes from where Jane was born.
Oh, that is very impressive. That's dedication.
That's dedication. So I spent, you know, many years in England, and just the idea of being in the audience at the Oxford Union.
Well, it was quite funny. I showed up and I had to check it. You have to check in, you know, so you come in and there's the walls of the union are all covered in people who have spoken there before. So I'm looking at Obama and Madeleine Albright, you know, and Laurence Olivier, and I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing here? And they come up and ask who I am, and I said, you know, I'm Cassandra Clare, I'm checking in, and my mother says, and her mom. And I was like, I bet Madeleine Albright didn't bring her mom.
Now to me that is the highest. I can't imagine any place better to speak at, you know, unless they gave you Carnegie Hall, but you are fantastic. It's so funny too, you were born in Tehran, which is interesting because I lived in Tehran.
Oh, that is far more unusual. I think, yes, I was born in Tehran. My parents moved around a lot. You know, that's why we spent time in London, Paris, Switzerland, you know, cities, remote places. And my father was teaching in Tehran when I was born. So, yeah, I've always, you know, I can baby talk a little bit in Farsi. So, you know, when I tell people who are Iranian that I'm, you know, I was born in Iran, they always get excited and they want to talk to me in Farsi, and I can only say things like, where's the kitty cat? And I would like some milk.
Do they say geschenk, geschenke, so that you were pretty? I bet they used to say that to you when you were a baby. They'd say geschenke, geschenke.
What they were really excited about, actually, was that I had red hair, and they would touch my hair, and they would say to my mother, she has the blood of Alexander, because their whole theory was that Alexander the Great, when he conquered Persia, brought blonde and red hair with him.
Exactly. Oh, wow. You know, and I didn't even mention the name of the book. My goodness, I get so excited. Well, the two things, I think the embargo and Oxford Union just got me. But the name of the book, of course, it's from the Shadowhunters novel series. Oh, my goodness. Chain of Thorns, The Last Hours. And again, this wonderful thing, it takes place a lot in London and Paris and the cities that we love and that I know you lived in.
Yes, absolutely. I love, as it sounds like you do, you know, the British classics, Sherlock Holmes, Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, you know, I adored growing up. And so that sort of time period, that kind of setting has always called to me, and I didn't see any reason why I couldn't do it and combine it with fantasy, because, you know, I'm always excited about the idea of combining genres, and so this is a story of, you know, murder and magic and the supernatural that is set in Edwardian London just 2 years after the Queen Victoria died.
You know, if for my listeners, so many of them, of course, have seen the television and the movies, but I have to tell them the books are so much better. The books are so, they are so good. It's sort of like Sue Grafton was a guest here on the program.
Oh, and I love her book.
Yeah, we were friends. And so she never sold her rights because she just couldn't take it. She didn't want to see what they would do because we had both worked on scripts. And so we knew that the books don't translate quite the way the author hopes, because really your books are so, so much better. They are really fantastic.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Yeah, somebody once gave me a T-shirt that said, "Don't judge a book by its movie."
I think so. So, wow. What do you want to say about the book? We can't say too much. They sent me this little pamphlet with just a... I love it. I treasure this.
I guess I would say that, I'm very excited now to be putting out the third book and to be finishing the trilogy. I know a lot of people like to wait for a series to be finished before they start reading, and so I would say now is a great time. You can get all three books and just read through them all, like binge-watching a TV show. And this has been one of my favorite series to write because I really do love the setting. I love the time period, and I really adore these characters. It's very sad, for bittersweet for me to say goodbye to them at the end of the series. And I think, for anyone who likes, history, who likes mystery, who likes romance or adventure, any aspect of those things, there's something in the book for you. It's definitely a book with a big cast, a lot of different characters to relate to in different ways.
Oh, a lot of characters. And the thing is,
I know.
It's a lot of characters. But it's so much fun to read. So tell us just a little bit about Cordelia and a little bit about Matthew and the basic storyline that we can't give too much away, but just to intrigue my listeners.
Of course. Cordelia is a young woman who has spent a lot of time with her family traveling all over the world and never stay in one place for very long, so that's definitely drawn from my own experience. Her mother is Iranian. They would have said Persian in 1903, so she's half Persian, and I, took some of my own memories of sort of the food and the some cultural things about Iran to build her character. So the enormous scandal happens. Her father is accused of a terrible crime, and she feels she must travel to London and clear his name. She gets to London. She is drawn into this mystery. Someone has been killing shadow hunters, who are these magical race of people to which she belongs, who fight demons. And someone's been killing them and leaving their bodies around London. They seem like Jack the Ripper killing, so they think, maybe it's the same kind of thing. But as they begin to investigate, they realize that this is not a human being killing other human beings. This is a supernatural force, and it's trying to accomplish something through these murders. And through all of this, you know, Cordelia, she, you know, becomes a warrior. She finds her strength. She falls in love with a boy named James Herondale. Tragically, he is in love with someone else. Matthew, meanwhile, his best friend, falls in love with her. So we have some complications. We have some love triangles. We have some murder. We have some mystery. We've got some of everything.
Exactly. So explain where you came out with the idea of Shadow Hunters in the first place, where they come from, and because they are fighting demons. And it comes all the way back to your first idea about this whole subject.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by folklore and mythology. And I remember the idea came to me when I was in a tattoo shop with a friend of mine who was a tattoo artist, and she was showing me her designs. And I thought, you know, I've never gotten a tattoo. It's very funny that I've written a whole series of books about people with tattoos because I don't have one. But I was looking at her, I'm too cowardly, I was looking at her designs, and I thought, and she was telling me kind of the history of tattoos, how, you know, they were, almost all cultures have some, you know, method of inking the skin with marks, and there's always been a belief that these marks would be protective in battle, or they would stop you from bleeding, or they would be healing. And I thought, what if there was a race of people for whom this tattoo-based magic really worked? And that's sort of how Shadow Hunters came to be. I thought, well, okay, you know, they're this band of warriors. They use these sort of magical tattoos to make themselves stronger, faster. You know, what are they fighting? Okay, they're fighting demons. And so that was the sort of the genesis of the idea of the Shadow Hunters, and how they were this secret society that people didn't know about, but their job was to protect humanity.
And it goes all the way, it starts off in the 11th century, right?
That's correct. It's 1,000 years ago during the Crusades.
Now, explain this word. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it. I want to hear you pronounce it. How do you pronounce it?
Is it Parabatai?
Parabatai.
Yeah, no one can pronounce it. You're not alone. I was thinking of doing it like some kind of a pronunciation guide for the books. It's a Greek word, and I'm not even sure that I am pronouncing it correctly. This is what I was told by a friend who teaches Greek and Latin. So they said parabatai, so that's how I say it. In Greek military history, these were two warriors who fought together. One was the sort of the charioteer, the other was the side man, you know, sort of shooting arrows from the chariot. So one drove, the other fought. And so in the book, the concept is that this is someone that you choose to be your parabatai, who is your warrior partner. It's a platonic bond. You fight together. You're bonded to each other. If one of you dies, the other one, you know, is going to nearly die. So it's based on that Greek history, but I sort of put a magical spin on it.
Well, of course, you have an interest in Greek mythology and all of this. You use allegory a great deal in your writing.
Mm-hmm.
Explain sort of your background, how your education, where did this all come from? Just from your reading? Did you study it in school?
I think it comes from my reading. Like, because we did travel so much, my parents were constantly pulling me out of school. So, you know, I'd often be in school for half a year, and then they'd take me out, and so we could go somewhere. And I remember when my father needed to finish, I think it was his thesis for his job as a professor. I was like 9 or 10, so I didn't know what he was doing. And so he wanted somewhere quiet, so he took me and my mother to a remote area in Switzerland where there was literally nobody around for miles. And as you can imagine, as a, you know, 9-year-old child, this is not your ideal situation. So I just read, you know, I read all the time. And I think it's from that. I would read whatever was in a house. I would take down the book and read it. So it taught me to read very widely and read outside my, you know, comfort zone, or read books that I didn't know that I was necessarily going to like until I did read them. And I think that gave me a very sort of broad base of mythology, allegory, folklore to draw on, and a really interesting sort of group of things that fascinated me that I might not otherwise have encountered. And my mother would also teach me, you know, we did a homeschooling so that I could, you know, pass into the next grade when we got home. But I really do think it was the reading.
Well, now your books have been translated, I think, into 34 or 35 languages. How many languages do you speak?
I speak French. I speak Italian badly and Spanish badly.
Well, so at least you can read a little bit of you.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, in French, I can read my books. And I think that that's always interesting, you know, to see how that translator has handled, you know, whatever, you know, things you have done in your books, especially jokes, which are probably, I think, the hardest thing to translate. But in most other languages, I can't tell.
Well, before you came on while I was waiting for you, because I didn't have any other guests today, I didn't want to have anybody else today but you. I was talking about your illustrations, and I was thinking about, you know, you work with a true artist who creates amazing artwork for you. Now, what do you do with the covers of the? Do you have like a wall or a house covered now with all of these?
Well, the artist who does my covers, Cliff Nielsen, he is a wonderful artist, and what he does is he takes photographs and then he paints over the photographs. And so it's this kind of fascinating combination of like his own painting and digital photography. Then there are several artists I've also worked with, you know, on other covers. So it's true. I have a set of the covers that's framed in one of the guest rooms of my house. And then there was also an artist named Kathleen Jennings who did a set of silhouettes, like paper cutout silhouettes, which were extremely popular, as I'm sure you know, in the Victorian and Edwardian era. And she did silhouettes of all the characters out of paper cutouts, and those became the illustrations in Chain of Iron, which was the second book. And I bought the originals from her because I just loved them so much. They're so beautiful. And so those are framed also in my office.
Well, of course, I don't have to ask if you what you're writing next. I'm sure you're writing. I love on your website on the front, it says, contemporary milieu, sharp milieu. Dialogue. Claire's female characters are smart and sassy, which is what probably describing you.
I mean, I'd like to think that I'm sassy. I'm working on it.
I think so. Absolutely. And now I realize too, there is another goal for writers. You know, I didn't think about it, but J.K. Rowling's got it, and she got her theme park. So,
My goodness! Can you imagine?
This is your next level, I think, because where else are you going to go? You're embargoed until January 31st. I can't read; they won't let me.
Well, I know. I'm like, I don't know. I'll have to talk to my agents about who has my theme park rights. They do exist. They're part of your contract. That someone owns your theme park ride. Right, but I can't think of anyone besides J.K. Rowling and some famous authors now dead who have theme park rides.
Well, no, you know, I think they could make a theme park out of you. Some of them, they could make some heck of rides. Because
from your lips to God's ears, I would love to have a theme park. Well, you're right. I'll make that my next goal.
Well, you know, I'm here in Florida.
I'm gonna say I want to ride.
You know, I'm here in Florida. you know, I'm 45 minutes from Orlando, where we have, of course, the Harry Potter theme park. And I'm sure, you know, tonight I'm sure kids are lining up at bookstores. It's nice that there are bookstores still. And that they will be lined up like they were for the Harry Potter books. You know, your books are very big. How many pages is this new one?
They are long, but you know, so were the Harry Potter books. I feel like, you know, there's a kind of book where you want to just kind of be in the world, and my readers are always asking how long the books are, and they always want them to be longer than they are.
Oh, exactly.
And I'm like, we can't go any longer.
You can't lift them.
They are very good for as paperweights. But, I mean, what I generally say to people when we talk about length is really it's often a function of character. There are a lot of characters in the Chain of Thorns series. You know, there's the big group of friends, and they all kind of have their own story, and so those stories interweave, makes for a longer book. And I always loved a long book when I was a kid.
Me
so I think
too.
You often
I love long
what
books.
You enjoyed,
and I'm it gives me hope when kids can read long books. It's great. It means they they get if a book gets them excited, they will read it. And you know, all those problems with are kids going to be reading books in the future? Yeah, if they're really great, they read them.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's, you know, oh my goodness. I mean, I remember once I was signing, there was a, you know, a long line. It was probably a 3-hour line. And the people at the back of the line, by the time they came to the front, had read the book that had just come out. And I was like, it took me a year to write that, and you just read it in 3 hours. But I was very happy because I thought, you know, these are kids. They clearly couldn't wait. They're clearly huge readers, and they just devoured it. And that's what you want.
Yeah, and they will. They'll devour. It's amazing. The kids will devour one of these big books, 500, 600 pages, in a few hours, like you said, 3 hours. They would do that when the Harry Potter, they would be in the bookstore. They'd sit down in the corner. They'd leave the book, you know, they'd open at midnight, and everything would be going. But there'd always be some kids who would sit in the corner, you know, just sit, plop down and read until they, and of course they reread it then. Then they had the fun.
Of course, that's part of the fun.
They read it once, and they read it again, and they read it over. And like my goddaughter, Kanisha, she's still rereading Harry Potter books. Because, you know, it's fun, and that's what you've done here with your books. You have this, well, of course, you're a fantastic writer. I mean, your writing is good. I can recognize the sort of the influences that you've had in your writing because, as you said, you love Dickens, and he certainly knew how to tell a good story, and you are a
and
great...
And he wrote a long book, too.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I love him, and I last year I reread Nicholas Nickleby, you know, all the pages. I wanted to, you know, do the whole book again because I remembered it from when I was young, and in between I had read a few parts of it. But this time I did it with the audio. I read the book and the audio. It was fantastic. So I know that the kids are going to have, young people, because it's not kids. It's young adults, and it's adults. A lot of adults are reading it. I know now my goddaughter's, like 30 years old, but she's going to be reading it because that's what they do.
Absolutely. You know, some books you grow up with, and some books, and many books are timeless, you know. Especially coming of age novels, because that's something that either, you know, you can read while you're going through it, or you can read when you're older and you remember it. You know, you remember that time period in your life.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. As I said, you're my first embargoed author on Joy on Paper.
Embargoed author.
It's coming up to the 8th anniversary of Joy on Paper, and I've talked to over 1,500 authors in this time. And I'm so glad that I have the first embargoed one.
Oh, well, that's very sweet. And, you know, my first embargoed book, I called my parents to say I've been embargoed, and they thought it was a bad thing. They thought I meant that my book had been banned. I was like, no, embargoed is good.
Oh, well, again, Cassandra Clare, you're fantastic. People, you can find her books wherever books are sold, and you can stand in line at midnight on, it's going to be released January 31st, but pre-order it. I'm sure your pre-orders are now already in the million, at least a million, so you know.
Well, I hope so. They don't tell me.
I know they
later,
don't tell you.
So I'll find out at some point. But yes, go ahead and pre-order it. There's a special collector's edition that's just the first print run of the book. So once those are gone, they're gone forever. So, you know, pre-order that to get the version with the illustrations and all the cool stuff. And thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's been a joy to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay,
bye.
Bye. All right. Woo, woo. What a book. What a book. All right, everybody. That was a nice interview. I enjoyed talking to her. Oxford Union. Oh, to talk to the Oxford Union. That should be. That's my goal. But I don't think I'm ever going to write a book that will invite me there. Bye-bye now.